Hello, and welcome to the Epic Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ann Corson. Today, we are very honored to have with us as a guest, Dr. Andy Wakefield, who went from being a highly published and respected academic surgical gastroenterologist in London and a scientist to one of the most highly vilified doctors in the world, to a hero among the autism community, and then to a remarkable filmmaker whose films have really had a very profound effect around the world. So good morning, Dr. Wakefield, and thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, Anne. It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
There was one quote on the website Seventh Chakra Films about you, and I think it's a really good introduction for you to start telling us a little bit about your story. And I quote, "Wakefield did what all good doctors and scientists are supposed to do, used logic and reason to explore connections in nature between man and microbes. By investigating, which is the absolute foundation of science, and reporting his findings using ethical guidelines and traditional scientific methods, Wakefield's career in medicine was cut short." Can you tell us how that happened and why?
Yes, certainly. Just very briefly, by way of background, like you, I'm one of six generations of my family that went to the same medical school. Mine was St. Mary's Hospital in Paddington in London, which was famous for the discovery of penicillin, amongst other things. Alexander Fleming worked there. And I trained in medicine, graduated in 1981, and then went into surgery with a specific interest in gastrointestinal diseases such as Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, inflammatory bowel diseases that were epidemic and were enigmas. We did not know the origin of these, this new wave of inflammatory bowel disease. And so I put together a research team. We were about 19 strong working at the Royal Free Hospital in North London, part of the University of London, an academic institution. And we published, as you say, quite widely on some novel observations on this disorder. So in 1995, because of the work I was doing, I started getting a series of calls, starting with a very articulate, intelligent, professional mother who said that my child was developing perfectly normally. He had speech interaction with his siblings. He had language. He was continent. He was both fecally and urinary continent. And he had his MMR vaccine. And very soon after that, he fell unwell. He went to sleep, woke up. He was never the same child. The lights in his eyes had gone out, and he was ultimately diagnosed with autism. And I knew nothing about autism at all. It was so rare when I was at medical school that we weren't even taught about it. The estimate was probably 1 in 10,000 children, but that was vague because of the rarity of the condition. And so I said, why you called me? And she said, I've called you because my child has terrible and intractable gastrointestinal problems that the doctors put down to just autism. That's just autism, you know, you have to get used to that. And this was diarrhea 10, 12 times a day, abdominal pain, distension, failure to thrive, all of the features that you and I recognize as synonymous with an underlying inflammatory bowel disease until proven otherwise. And this is the key. So we had an obligation, absolute moral and professional obligation, to investigate these children to determine if the parent's story was right, whether it held up, whether there was an underlying gastrointestinal disease which had come on at the same time as this child's developmental regression into autism. And my training, and I'm sure yours was as well, and the training of my generations in medicine, my many generations of family who've gone to that same medical school, was to listen. The art of medicine, the art which is largely lost now to the quasi-science of medicine, the art of medicine, the ability of the doctor to listen without bias, and to glean from the patient's story the origin of their disorder, their disease. That is the art of medicine. And so my training was in large part in listening. Why is that so important? Because almost invariably, that will lead you to the cause of the problem. If you listen to a mother about what is wrong with her child, no one knows that child like her mother. No one in the world. No one ever will. And so if she tells you something in all sincerity, she wasn't anti-vaccine, took her child to be vaccinated on time, she is merely reporting this is what happened, then that is where you, that is your starting point in clinical medicine. And so we investigated these children. I put together a team of outstanding clinicians, including Professor John Walker Smith, the world's leading pediatric gastroenterologist at the time, who wrote the textbook that taught today's pediatric gastroenterologists. And we investigated these children. And lo and behold, the parents were right. The mother was right. The children had a mild but novel inflammatory bowel disease. And what was fascinating about it is when we treated this bowel disease, this inflammation, with the kind of medication, the kind of interventions that we might use in Crohn's or colitis, standard inflammatory bowel disease medications, not only was there an improvement in the child's gastrointestinal problems, but there was an improvement in their autism as well. We didn't cure autism, but the children started using words they hadn't used for 5 years. That was extraordinary. And we thought that didn't happen. Because we're academic, we thought that didn't happen. So we did it again, and we did it again. And by the time I left there, we'd done it 180 times with different children, and it worked virtually every time. It was fascinating. And so there was something genuine, something real about this. But it was deeply unpopular. To pursue the vaccine issue was really, really thorny. And my colleagues in this investigation team said to me, Andy, we cannot, as pediatricians, be seen to question the safety of MMR vaccine. Now, that meant nothing to me. That wasn't a medical point of view, and it wasn't a scientific point of view. It was, how will my colleagues perceive me at the Royal College if I'm shown to be calling into question the safety of a vaccine? What about the children who are suffering? What about the children sitting across the desk from you, to whom you have a primary responsibility, not to your reputation as a, how your colleagues might perceive? Anyway, so there was on this issue a falling out. I decided that I had absolutely no choice. According to my professional training and my sort of humanitarian view of the world, that I had to do this job, and I did, and that was really the beginning of the end of my medical career.
You had to tell the truth. you had to tell what you observed, and you had to be honest about the improvement that the children had once you treated them for this inflammation. So you all published a paper in 1998 in The Lancet, which has since been retracted. I don't know how many years ago it was retracted, although, it was circulated widely and many of us have that paper. There were 13 authors on that paper. And I've heard you say that three of the authors were accused of all kinds of things. Two were struck off. One was you, and then another fellow who was struck off had the finances to be able to fight it, and fought it in the highest court in England, and then got his license back, whereas you did not. But my question is, why were all of the authors attacked the way you were? Why is it that you were singled out, really, or the two or three of you were singled out among the whole group that authored that case report? It was really a case report of 12 children. It was just an observational study.
That's exactly right. And to get this in context, which you clearly appreciate, is that this was merely a report of the first 12 children. And you know that the way in which human disease syndromes are described are usually in a handful of people, whether it's multiple sclerosis or AIDS or Crohn's disease or autism itself. It's usually in a handful of people observed by an astute physician to have a constellation of signs and symptoms that are idiosyncratic and unique, that they are consistent across a group of children or a group of individuals. And that's what this was. It could draw no conclusions other than further work needs to be done. It didn't say at any point the vaccine causes the problem. It said, this does not prove an association between the vaccine and the disorder described. Further work is necessary to clarify this. But of course, the media have portrayed this paper as claiming that the vaccine causes autism. No, it did not. But I took the view, and this is why they went after me, that I had to investigate this further, which I did. And that threatened the vaccine industry, it threatened their bottom line, it threatened government policy, it threatened international vaccine policy. And clearly, it was perceived as a huge threat. So they came after me. Rupert Murdoch appointed, well, his son, James Murdoch, was appointed to the board of GlaxoSmithKline, Europe's biggest MMR manufacturer, as a non-executive director. And his job was to protect that company's name, reputation in the media. And his job was to come after me, which he did rather effectively. And he said a journalist, a reporter onto me, who made up an extraordinary series of stories. And they had to go after three people. They had to go after the three people who were leading this team, including the eminent Professor John Walker Smith, just coming up to his retirement. And they had to get us all in order to get me and to try and stop this work. And so we, as you say, the culmination of all of this was that John Walker Smith had the funding to take his case to the High Court. The first time it had ever gone before a proper judicial body, the General Medical Council, our licensing board, these weren't trained lawyers. And the judge was extraordinarily critical of the General Medical Council. He said they could not handle evidence. They didn't understand the meaning of evidence, and worse, they were biased. And he said this must never happen again. And Professor Walker Smith was completely reinstated. The GMC, the General Medical Council, was demolished. Now, the problem for me is that I didn't have the funding to fight that case in the High Court, in the English High Court. And it would have cost me probably half a million pounds. And I simply didn't have that. And so I lost my license, and that where that remains. But everything, and I will say this categorically, everything that was reported in the Lancet paper is true, was true at the time, and has been proven subsequently. So I don't need to say any more. That's where it is.
You came to testify for the U.S. Congress in the year 2000, and I would encourage everyone to watch that 14-minute clip that's on Dr. Wakefield's website, and we'll make sure that the link is below because it's just a wonderful testimony. How was it that you actually, at that time, 2 years after that paper was published, how were you invited to testify for the United States Congress?
Well, it was a great honor. It was a wonderful experience. I had been giving a series of talks at autism meetings in the United States. And those in themselves were a fascinating experience because I was for the first time talking to parents. Usually, as you know, you go to a medical conference and it's terribly formal and you speak for 10 minutes, sit down, or not, they criticize you and off you go. Here was a conference where the vast majority were parents of vaccine-injured children, or allegedly vaccine-injured children, and I presented the information to them. And as a consequence of that, parents who were politically influential or connected asked me if I would come and testify before the U.S. Congress. And the chairman of the government's oversight committee at the time, Dan Burton, was himself the grandfather of a vaccine-injured child with severe autism. And so there was a series of hearings on autism under the direction of that congressman at that time. So a very interesting experience. But
unfortunately, it doesn't seem that much came out of those, though. They sort of stalled, much like the talks on Lyme disease. You know, I did a lot of testifying about Lyme and tick-borne diseases, you know, in the Pennsylvania legislature and elsewhere. And it all kind of gets stuck, you know. I've also spoken at Autism One. So, yeah, it's really nice to be able to speak to parents and whatnot. Let's talk a little bit about your move into filmmaking. How did you choose to come settle in the United States? How did that happen?
Well, it became impossible. What I realized very early on is this was not going to go well in England. The way in which the health system is set up and the research infrastructure in the UK is set up is that you are dependent very much on the government. Then Margaret Thatcher withdrew a lot of the funding for university science from that pool and said, you are going to have to enter into strategic alliances with the pharmaceutical industry to fund your research. Well, immediately, you can imagine, that biases any research that gets done to what they want to get done. So my medical school did exactly that. They entered into a strategic alliance with GlaxoSmithKline. And that allowed GlaxoSmithKline, for a very small amount of money, pocket change for them, but a lot of money to starving academics in university hospitals, it allowed them to dictate not only what research was done, but what research was not done. And my research was not going to be done. And so I lost my job at the Royal Free Hospital. I realized very early on that I would have to move to the States because there is a much more philanthropic approach to independent research funding in America. There is a wonderful infrastructure here. And unless you've lived and tried to work in another country like the UK, you won't appreciate just how good the system is here. And so I came and we set up an autism center in Austin, Texas, and that went very well and is still functioning. So to continue the work, I had to lose my country, lose my career, lose my license and all those things. But that was, you know, that was part of the deal, I guess, for getting the work done or continuing the work. Eventually, they managed to stop me working in the United States of America in my chosen field, that is, in the research into this problem. And so what had happened over the years is that people had come to me from the pharmaceutical industry, vaccine manufacturers, and from federal agencies like the CDC with extraordinary tales of doing bad, of committing fraud. They would come to me and say, we can trust you, we've done a terrible thing, and here is the evidence. And so I had these extraordinary stories, insider stories, whistleblower stories, and I decided that it was time to turn these into film. And so that was really the beginning. I started working with the Autism File magazine that then became a show. And then from that, we started a reality TV series, treating families, treating children with autism and healing the family as a consequence. That was in Europe on the Sky Information Network. And then we shifted operations to America and to making full-length documentary features.
Yes, your first film, Who Killed Alex Sporadoculus? Would you tell us a little bit about how that film came about and then the incredible effect that it actually had as a result of one human being seeing that film? Would you tell us that story, please?
Yes, it was fascinating. We were doing this reality TV series, which was before, during, and after. So taking the child who was injured, who was profoundly autistic, who had severe gastrointestinal problems, getting them properly investigated and diagnosed for their underlying bowel disease, and getting that treated properly and showing that you could help heal not only the child, but the family that had been dragged into this terrible situation as well. And so that was going well until we were called in to see one child in Chicago, and he was, at the time it reported to us, he was in 4-point locked restraints, chained to the bed, and he was given up to 28 psychotropic medications. This was an absolute disaster. This was a sort of abject failure of medicine to understand what autism was, let alone how to treat it. So they, we went to help get him out of there, and we did, and we got him. We took him, we drove him through the night to New York, where he was investigated and his underlying bowel disease diagnosed, and he was put on the right treatment. And things were going well. But his mother was estranged from her husband and had nowhere to live, nowhere permanent to live with her son and his godmother in Chicago. And so they would travel from hotel to motel. And the tragedy for this child is that every time he heard a siren, which there are many in Chicago, he would have a meltdown. They were coming to take him away again. They were coming to chain him to the bed. They were coming to lock him up again. And so he would have a meltdown. He was entirely nonverbal, very large and aggressive on all of these medications. And he would destroy the room, and they would be thrown out and moved on. So they were beyond exhaustion. He fell back into the hands of child psychiatrists and was drugged again, put in the pediatric intensive care unit of Lutheran Hospital, where he was once again chained to the bed and given, put on two intravenous and one intramuscular sedations that really still didn't control his violence. And we went to try and find somewhere to get him out of there, to somewhere safe where this child could recuperate and get be weaned off these medications. Unfortunately, halfway through the week, his insurance ran out. And so they took off his restraints, they took out his ID, and they put him on the street. And a week later, his mother stabbed him to death. And the mother and godmother tried to take their own lives. And this was portrayed in the media as a crazy mother who hated her child and wanted him dead. Nothing could have been further from the truth. This was a mother who had gone above and beyond for this boy and was now in a state of utter despair.
Tell the listeners how old he was and how much he weighed at that time.
He was 17, and I guess he was probably 260 pounds. Strong and aggressive, and these poor women were beyond exhaustion trying to cope with him. And they realized in their desperation that there was only one answer for them all. The mother and godmother survived and went to prison. And as I say, the media took this on as a, all apart from one show, took it on as this crazy mother, this mother who hated her child. And we had all this footage. We'd shot the whole thing, and we realized that we had the ability to tell the truth. What really happened here? Who was really responsible? Hence the sort of irony inherent in the question, who killed Alex Bordelakis? Why did this child really die? And so we made a documentary, and it was pretty hard hitting. It was a tough one, but it nonetheless told the story. She was in prison for 4 years without ever having gone to trial. When I got a call one Christmas from her lawyer, Aldo Botti, a wonderful man working pro bono in Chicago. And he said, Andy, I got a call from the state's prosecutor who was responsible for putting her in prison and keeping her there for life. And he said to me, I understand a film has been made about this. We would like to see it. And he said, I sent them the last copy, the last DVD I had. And he called me back a few weeks later and he said, we've now had a chance to review this film. We can no longer prosecute this case in the same way. She will be released from prison next week. And this was an extraordinary story. This was the first time, as I understand it, in legal history that such a thing had happened. That a film, the power of a film to tell the truth, had persuaded a state's prosecutor not only to not charge, say, but to release her the following week on probation. And that's what happened. And so it made me realize it was one of those moments, rather like that little boy on the beach throwing the starfish back into the sea. Millions of starfish being eaten by gulls. Someone stopping him and saying, why are you doing this? You know, there are millions of starfish, and he said, well, it helped that one, didn't it? And this helped that one. This made a huge difference. But it did set a precedent which had never happened before. But it did make me realize also the power of film, how film handled properly, told truthfully, can change things dramatically. And so that's when I shifted from this sort of reality show thinking to into full-length feature films.
It's wonderful. Isn't it wonderful that that prosecutor actually had the interest to want to see it? So you really have to give him credit, too, for how many prosecutors would have even been interested in seeing your film.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. I, you're quite right.
I give him credit as well for that, yeah. The next feature-length documentary that you made is a film called Vaxxed, you know, W-A-X-X-E-D. And it's been a remarkable film. As I said, I have several copies here in my office that I will, you know, either give out or loan out to my patient population. And I wanted you to give us a little bit of history about how that came about, because I understand that a PhD by the name of Brian Hooker, who teaches in a college in the United States, he's a biologist, who has a very severely vaccine-injured autistic son, had been at the CDC for many years to try to get information from them about, you know, in, under the Freedom of Information Act, and that finally, one of the lead researchers, Dr. William Thompson, had approached him, I guess, with remorse and guilt over what the CDC had done, and that through your interaction with Brian, you asked him to record that phone call and that information, and then you've built this incredible documentary around that. And so tell us a little bit about Vax, then.
Certainly.
People who have never seen it.
Yes, Vax kind of changed everything. The background of Vax is it went back in when I went to testify before the U.S. Congress. I also had a meeting with senior researchers in the public health, in people from the FDA and the CDC at Cold Spring Harbor. And they said, okay, everybody, every child gets MMR vaccine. Why don't all children develop autism? Well, that's a kind of naive question if you understand anything about medicine at all. You can smoke and never develop lung cancer. That doesn't mean smoking doesn't cause lung cancer. So, but I said, look, what we think, we were interested in patterns of viral exposure, including vaccination, and including age. I said to them, I believe it's the, at least in part, related to age of exposure, that the younger you are when you get the vaccine, the greater the risk. So it's not evenly spread across all ages. It's, and we know this now with COVID. Everybody knows, the whole world knows that there is an age-specific risk associated with the exposure to SARS-CoV-2 virus. Older people are at greater risk than younger people. So I said, you know, I think it's age of exposure, at least in part. And so, and the reason for saying that is we knew that with the wild viruses like measles, if you got it under one, you were at greater risk of a severe outcome than you were if you got it over one. Intuitively, perhaps because the immune system may be more developed, more robust. We didn't know, but that was the sort of thinking. The CDC, to their credit, went away under William Thompson and did that investigation. Is age of exposure to MMR a risk? And they found absolutely that it was. The younger you got the vaccine, the greater the risk. And they spent the next 14 years covering that up, destroying the documents. And this came to my attention, as you say, through my good friend Brian Hooker. He had been in contact over the years with William Thompson, and William Thompson cracked under the strain of having perpetrated this fraud and said, we've done a terrible thing. Here is the evidence. My colleagues destroyed their documents and to cover this up. I realized that that was against the law, and so I kept mine, and here they are. So we put together this extraordinary story of the CDC deliberately, wantonly and recklessly putting American children and by proxy children around the world in harm's way, in the way of a permanent, serious neurological disease in order to protect themselves and to protect the vaccine program. Not to protect the children, to protect the program. And so we made the movie, and we decided when we made the movie, with Brian's help, and that we would submit it to one film festival and one only, and that was the highly prestigious Tribeca Film Festival under Robert De Niro in New York. And it got in, and we were delighted. And then just a few weeks before Tribeca, it was pulled. Ultimately, we learned that it was pulled because of financial influences upon the Tribeca Film Festival that threatened to withdraw funding if they didn't pull that film. And this was the first time a film had been pulled from an independent film festival in this way. And what happened was, it was a bad 3 days. When it happened, my film career was over completely. And then on the third day, Robert De Niro went on the Today Show, Good Morning America, and said, we should not have done that. We made a mistake. Everybody should see this film. We did a bad thing. And suddenly it exploded worldwide. The De Niro effect made it a worldwide phenomenon. Suddenly there was this forbidden movie, with one that they didn't want us to see. And so that's where it went. And it went all around the world. And it,
how many people have seen it, do you think?
You know, I have absolutely no idea, because the wonderful thing is that it's been pirated so many times. We have no way of keeping track of it. But it was profound, because the irony of this, of course, is that their attempts to censor it backfired.
Yeah.
We're all familiar with censorship now, but then they weren't terribly clever. And they censored this film, and it backfired on them. And maybe if it had played at Tribeca, 100 people would have seen it, and big deal. This way, millions of people saw it. And so thank you very much. And particularly thank you to Robert De Niro for being candid about the error of withdrawing the film. And so it really changed everything, and it caused the other side to go into a kind of meltdown. They weren't sure how to handle this. And people said to me, you know, others who critics said, well, you've just made it all up. That didn't happen that way at all. We would never have made that film if we did not have William Thompson on record, if we did not have the documents, if we were not absolutely certain. Because we accused the five scientists, right up to the head of the CDC at the time, of one of the worst humanitarian crimes ever. Why? Because these people were sworn. It was their duty to protect the health of the children of this country. And they did exactly the opposite. If there had been one lie, one mistake in that film, they would have sued us to the moon and back again. And there wasn't a whisper, not a single whisper. Why? Because they knew it was true. And that was facts. And then we moved on from there. We realized that here was an opportunity to educate the public in complex issues, but reduce them to an entertaining story that they would want to watch and learn from. And so as long as we stuck to the truth at all times, then film was the way to go.
I never did understand whatever happened to William Thompson. I tried to find that out. Is he still with the CDC? They sort of put him in a basement office someplace without a phone. What's happened to him?
They moved him to HIV research. They moved him out of the vaccine safety office. But they didn't want to get rid of him, because if they got rid of him, they no longer had control over him. And he went on to get his pension. I imagine he's probably retired by now. But he spent too long close to the people who represented a huge threat to his very survival. What happened was, Congress at this stage should have subpoenaed him and brought him before the Oversight Committee, or it should have gone to court and he should have been subpoenaed. Neither of those happened. Nobody wanted those to happen. So I spent hours, days, sitting in front of the chairman of the Oversight Committee at the time, urging him to call William Thompson, preparing the deposition of William Thompson for him so he didn't have to do anything. His staffers were desperately keen not to have this on the record. And every time we met with them, the next people through the door would be one of these front organizations for the pharmaceutical industry, ostensibly charities, you know, 501c, but they really were front industries, front organizations, saying, you really don't want to do this. Why? Because if parents stop vaccinating their children and those children die, it will be your fault. How do you feel about that? And that was the sort of leverage that they used. It was totally dishonest. And so for many, many years, millions of children continue to be put in harm's way and still do to this day because of the failure of the politicians to man up and act appropriately.
And the failure of the medical teaching institutions and the practicing medical physicians to realize the harm that they are doing because of the dogma that they've been taught, that is just drives me crazy when I see that physicians, maybe they think they're doing the right thing, but they're actually harming children as they grow. It's just horrible. But, you know, this happened quite some time ago. And it's really sad when here you've exposed tremendous fraud, deceit, and criminal activity by the CDC. And then you juxtapose that to what's happened over the last 2 years. And, you know, we haven't learned yet. The people haven't learned yet not to trust this really criminal organization who's doing the same thing now with these COVID vaccines that they've been doing with the childhood vaccine schedule all along. Would you comment on those parallels?
And I wouldn't despair. Let me tell you why. When I started in this 30 years ago, there were literally a handful of us worldwide who were prepared to openly discuss the issues of vaccine safety. Now that number is more than half the adult world. That is where we are. That is where we have come to. And if one appreciates the history of this, one can understand that this is a huge sea change. And it has come about largely for two reasons. One is film. The films have been accessible to people, understandable to people, and widely available. But COVID, more than anything, COVID has changed people's minds because people have realized just how bent out of shape the system is, just how deceitful it is. And sadly, as each day goes by, as I'm sure you're fully aware, as the story unravels, the rate of adverse reaction unravels, the truth about in the science, as new papers emerge saying, just today, I got one, young people at zero risk of mortality from COVID should never be given the vaccine, and yet they are suffering myocarditis and other serious complications at a rate that is way over anything that they would have possibly experienced with the natural disease, say natural disease, you know, in quotes. But so people now have come to that position, and people are simply saying, no, I may have had the first dose, I may not, but I'm not having the second, or I may have had the first and seconds, but I'm not having the booster. So don't try and persuade me that that. So
one of the positives,
very different world.
One of the positives I see is that mainstream physicians and scientists who normally would never question vaccine safety are now saying things like, I'll never take any vaccine again. I mean, I heard Mark Yaden say that. Even Peter McCullough is questioning, you know, the vaccine schedule overall. So that one silver lining to this horrible damage and death and disability that's happening from these injections is that it's making everyone rethink the whole vaccine industry and take a look at the safety of the vaccines in general, which I think is very, very important. I'd like you to tell us just a little bit about 1986, the Act, and why it is important for people to understand what happened with that legislation, and then how you constructed a story with which to explain that to the public in your film.
Yes, thank you very much. The 1986 Act, for those who don't know, and many people do now, is a law that was signed. It was signed into law by Reagan in 1986, and it effectively gave liability protection to the vaccine manufacturers for death and injury caused by their vaccines that were on the CDC's recommended schedule, so the childhood vaccine schedule. And at the time, there were a limited number of vaccines, and it was introduced because, largely because of the toxicity of the whole cell pertussis, the whooping cough vaccine. But it now applies to all vaccines on that childhood schedule. The Act was meant to do three things. It was meant to make vaccines safer by further research. It was meant to compensate children who had been injured. And it was put in place to offer manufacturers a degree of liability protection. And the reason for that is that they had come to the government and said, look, we're getting sued. You want kids to have these vaccines. It's not a big profit center for us. Unless you assume liability, take it away from us, we will stop making these vaccines. Children will die, and it'll be down to you. How do you feel? And sort of the government panicked. They're never in a more state of meltdown than they are in the face of infectious disease, as we've seen with COVID. They're headless chickens. They don't know what to do. And so they were open to this kind of blackmail from the pharmaceutical industry. And that's what happened. And so the Act came in, and the Act gave the pharmaceutical industry the perfect business model. They had a mandatory market. Children had to be vaccinated to go to school, and no downside, no liability, no costs associated with litigation against the damage done by their vaccines. And so all they could do was make a profit. And that's exactly what they did. And they expanded the vaccine program because they realized that they could introduce new vaccines like HIV and HPV without liability and make and magnify their profits many, many fold. And so what happened at that stage, and this is why it's so important to where we are now, is that because they became so wealthy, because they became so powerful, they bought doctors, they bought medical schools, effectively medical training. They taught people effectively what they should know and what they did not need to know. They bought the media, they bought the editorial, they bought medical journals, they own the medical journal editorial, what was published and what wasn't published. They bought politicians. They wrote policy, and they co-opted those agencies like the CDC and FDA that were there to regulate them. They actually bought them effectively in-house, and so they controlled everything. And that was a very, very dangerous situation. And this was a global policy. It wasn't just in the United States. And that's allowed them to do what they've effectively got away with COVID as well. And it's a tragic failure of the government to regulate these individuals on the one hand, but a measure of how dastardly these companies are. They're only answerable to their stockholders. Safety is not on their agenda. Indeed, safety gets in the way of getting a vaccine licensed. Why would you do studies that might expose a problem? Let's get it licensed and sell a lot of it and make a big profit. And then we have no liability downstream for anything that we might have found if we'd done the appropriate studies. And so all of this is now familiar to people in the context of COVID, but this has been going on for a very long time. So the purpose of the film was to take a highly complex piece of legislation, litigation, and medical science and try and make it entertaining. Now that, for a filmmaker, is a nightmare. How do you do that? How do you stop even your most avid fan falling asleep in 10 minutes? And so how to make it entertaining? And I was at a fundraiser in Los Angeles, and there was a celebrity couple there, and they said, we must get behind this. And I thought, I know what you can do. You can become Mr. and Mrs. In this film, it can be centered around you. You can represent every parent around every dinner table, every night of the year, in every country, saying, what are we going to do for our children about vaccination? Faced with the same dilemma. Now we care. As the audience, we now care. Why? Because their story is our story. Their outcome is our outcome. And so if they can solve it, we can solve it. If they can understand it, we can understand it. And so putting it into the hands of two parents in this narrative style really made it so much more easy to tell the story. It's still complex, but it's a very important story because it really helps people understand what actually happened.
It's wonderful because you use the dialogue between the mother and the father to go through several of the objections, pro and con, and it's just wonderful because it puts it into a format that anybody can understand because they've all had those kinds of arguments, right, within their own family or friend unit. So I think it's just wonderful. It is still very complex, and I really advise people to watch it more than once because or else watch it in pieces because it is dense still. But you do a wonderful job in that, and it's just fantastic. What people don't understand, though, is that that liability from the pharmaceutical industry is stripped if it can be proven in a court of law that they knew in advance and committed fraud, that they knew in advance that their products would be harmful. And there's a move now on to try to bring these to a grand jury and bring these into the court system because of all of the documentation that has been obtained under the Freedom of Information Act, that yes, these pharmaceutical companies did know in advance of the harms that they would do, and they still pushed forward with these products knowing that, and so they actually committed criminal acts and fraud. So hopefully that will be able to strip away their liability protection from the 1986 Act and the PREP Act as well.
I really do hope so. I sincerely hope so. But one of the problems, one of the dilemmas, and just as an aside, is that the individuals who commit this, who perpetrate these, don't care about the longevity of the company or the vaccine. I think that Moderna have yielded 5 billionaires so far. These people take their money and they move on. And so even if they've been part of a fraudulent practice at some stage in the licensing of this vaccine, they've moved on to bigger and better. This is the dilemma, is that the company remains to pick up the tab, but the people who were responsible for what happened in large part have moved on and made their money. And that's, again, part of the regulatory dilemma that needs to be resolved in this issue.
Well, they need to be held personally liable, hopefully.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the last few minutes, I'd like to just touch briefly on your most recent film, Infertility, A Diabolical Agenda, that you did together, I believe, with Bobby Kennedy, which is really a movie that talks about the intentional sterilization of women in Africa without their knowledge, against their will, and without their consent. Can you tell us just a little bit about that and what happened there?
Certainly, I'll be very quick. This is a story that I really put to one side for many years. People had said, do you think there's a population control agenda with these vaccines? And I thought that was a rather clumsy way of going about things. I was completely wrong, and this footage came to me through James Henry, who shot it in Africa. And I was asked to assemble it into a story, into a film. And it was incredible because it became quite clear that it was explicit. There was no ambiguity about it. The World Health Organization had been funding the development of an anti-fertility vaccine in New Delhi in India under Dr. Talwar since the 1970s. And by the 1990s, early 90s, they'd perfected that anti-fertility vaccine. And it was distributed. It was put out into developing countries in particular, like Kenya. And the footage comes from Kenya. And it was, here's the problem, is that not only were these women given an anti-fertility vaccine that may render them not only lose a successful pregnancy, abort a successful pregnancy, but stop them getting pregnant for however long. No one knew how long it would last. It may have been permanent. But they were told that it was an anti-tetanus vaccine program. So not only were they denied informed consent, they were lied to. They were told it was something that it wasn't, that they were doing something to protect their baby, their unborn baby, when in fact what they were doing was doing something to abort their unborn baby. It was an absolute ethical and moral disgrace, quite apart from anything else. And the story has been out there for a while, this debate. The value of this documentary is it resolves it. It brings to light, and I won't spoil it for people, but it brings to light who lied, who told the truth, who cheated, and who didn't. And so I was astonished by the outcome of this story, and I strongly recommend it. It's only half an hour. It's absolutely free. It's available on infertilitythemovie.com or infertilitymovie.org. Please take a look at it, because it. I was compelled to turn it into a film for the very simple reason that it resolved this argument, this debate, this dilemma that had been out there for some time.
One thing that film didn't provide that I was interested in knowing if you had any information about was the actual, are there statistics that have been gathered about the decreased rate of fertility, say, among the Kenyan women since this, you know, anti-HCG injection was given?
I don't think there have. And I think there would have been a huge reluctance to actually capture that information in any government-funded or government-controlled system. So I think that the facilities, the ability of the doctors locally to do that is very, very limited. And so you're absolutely right. This should have been done. But of course, it's much easier not to do it and therefore not to be culpable.
Yeah. Well, what I think is most important now is for vaccines to be made that are clean, that are not full of toxic adjuvants or full of contaminants. I heard Judy Mikovits once say that it would be easy to make clean and effective vaccines. Do you agree with that?
Judy is much more of an expert on this subject than I am. So far, they've completely failed to live up to that. That's not to say there isn't a place for safe and effective vaccines. If you can show me something that is genuinely safe and effective, well, that's a very different matter. So it's not anti-vaccine, it's pro-science. It's pro-parents having the choice of what goes into their children's bodies. It's pro-fully informed prior consent. In other words, parents must be given a full list of all of the known risks and benefits. So it's pro rather than anti. It's pro the health of children. And that's what I fight for.
So what's in the pipeline? What's coming out next with you?
Well, I've just come off a pre-production meeting. We start principal photography on a new full-length feature film that starts. We're filming here in Austin, Texas, starting in 3 weeks' time. So there's a sort of state of control panic at this end. It's a wonderful story. I co-wrote the story with Terry Rossio, who wrote little-known stories such as Shrek, Pirates of the Caribbean, Godzilla versus King Kong, Aladdin, Fast and Furious. It goes on and on and on. Anyway, so Terry and I wrote this together, and we start filming a full-length narrative feature in the genre of Erin Brockovich, The Insider, The Big Short, in 3 weeks' time. So we are going to be very, very busy for 6 weeks.
Well, we look forward to the finished product very much. And thank you so much today for being with us, Dr. Wakefield, on the Epic Health Podcast. It's been wonderful to speak with you. Thank you so much.
And my great pleasure. Thank you so much.